I'll wait for David to start.
Go ahead.
There it goes.
Yep.
All right.
Microphone. Why don't we say that we're at Ezekiel chapter 11 before we start, so that people from the recording, people Please. Listening to the recording, understand.
Joe always does that. Joe's perfect at that. So it'd be great if you would do that too, Noble. I'm kidding, right?
Moral.
Okay. Are we good?
Yeah, Ezekiel chapter 11.
Moreover, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me unto the east gate of Yahweh's house, which looks eastward. And behold, at the door of the gate, 25 men, among whom I saw Jazaniah, the son of Azar, and Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah, princes of the people. Then said he unto me, Son of man, these are the men that devise mischief and give wicked counsel in this city, which say, It is not near. Let us build houses. This city is the cauldron, and we be the flesh. Therefore prophesy against them. Prophesy, O son of man. And the Spirit of Yahweh fell upon me and said unto me, Speak, thus says Yahweh, thus have you said, O house of Israel, for I know the things that come into your mind, every one of them. You have multiplied your slain in this city, and you have filled the streets thereof with the slain. Therefore, thus says Yahweh God, your slain, whom you have laid in the midst of it, they are the flesh, and this city is the cauldron, but I will bring you forth out of the midst of it. You have feared the sword, and I will bring a sword upon you, says Yahweh God. And I will bring you out of the midst thereof and deliver you into the hands of strangers and will execute judgments among you. You shall fall by the sword. I will judge you in the border of Israel, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. This city shall not be your cauldron, neither shall you be the flesh in the midst thereof, but I will judge you in the border of Israel, and you shall know that I am Yahweh, for you have not walked in my statutes, neither executed my judgments, but have done after the manner of the heathen that are around about you. And it came to pass, when I prophesied, that Pelatiah the son of Benaiah died. Then fell I down upon my face and cried with a loud voice and said, O Yahweh God, will you make a full end of the remnant of Israel?
This is really like exemplary of how stiff-necked we could be. Yeah, you know, if you look at these names, Jazaniah means Yahweh hears, Pelatiah means Yahweh delivers, Benaniah means Yahweh has built. You can't even say your own name without the name of Yahweh being in your own name, and yet these are the men that devise mischief and give wicked counsel in the city. So how easy is it to forget God when his name is part of your own name? And your own name is basically a phrase referring to him, which means something that's true. If you wonder about the apostasy of today, these people having the temple of Yahweh in being able to go there and see it, and they still departed from it that easy. I mean, to me today, even average people are a lot more distant from God than the ancients were, because today that they substitute titles for his name. And the titles can mean anything or many things to different people, but they didn't have it like that at this time, I don't think, right?
Even today, we have many Jeremiahs and Elijahs, etc.
Yeah, we do. We have those people among us, but it's very... it's a lot rarer today, and there are only a couple of names like that. And in fact, right now, the only two that I can think of that are still in that are common in the South are Jeremiah, Elijah, or Micah is popular down here. Not too many people named Ezekiel. There are some, but not too many. And usually then it's just shortened to Zeke, right? Daniel is popular. That's popular outside the South, too, through all of the English-speaking nations. God is my judge is what it means. But I don't think... Ask most people what Daniel, what Daniel means, and they probably won't be able to tell you.
Even if their name is Daniel.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, right. Ask them what Daniel means. They probably think it's an Irish name. Oh, Danny boy.
It always amazes me, too, how intimate their relationship was with Yahweh. I mean, they had the pillar of fire, the cloud, the prophets, the temple, the miracles, and yet they just are stiff-necked from beginning to end.
Yeah, right. Well, that's just an elaboration on what I was trying to say, but yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, I'm only saying it because you made me think about it.
How can somebody be named Jazaniah, Yahweh hears, and want to blaspheme God because your very name means that he hears you? What the hell?
Yeah, it's ironic.
Yeah, it's completely ironic.
I wonder how many of the wicked kings of Israel and Judah had names like that.
Practically most, at least most of them.
Yeah.
I could probably say almost all of them.
What does Jeroboam mean?
Yeah, you know what, Noble? As soon as I had answered you, I thought to look up Jeroboam.
Great minds think alike.
Jeroboam, this says that it means the people will contend.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Okay.
It does, but I had also thought that that J-E part at the beginning had been a reference to Yahweh, but evidently it's not. In this instance, who means Jehovah is he, right? And that J-E means Yahweh, right? So I guess Jeroboam doesn't.
Microphone activated.
But that's okay. It's funny how we both thought it at the same time.
Oh, by the way, so the suffix AM is just a suffix for a male name, right?
The suffix AM usually means people.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not something that females would have in their name. It's always males, correct?
Miriam.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I didn't think of that, yeah.
Yeah, Mariam means, actually, it means rebellious people. Mariam. Mary is a Hebrew word that means rebel or rebellious. And it can also mean bitter. I'm sorry. I just totally forgot the word that I'm trying to relate.
Mara. It's Mara.
Yeah, right? Mara or Mary can mean bitter.
Or rebel. Yeah.
And that's an allegory. That's an allegorical use of the term, but it means rebellious, literally. Pretty sure. I might have that backwards. But the word Mara can mean bitter or rebellious. And Mara or Mariam means rebellious people. And that's very that is very profound when you think about the birth of Christ, that his mother's name means rebellious people, that God was born of a rebellious people. Yeah. To me, that's like no better name.
Yeah.
So yes, women can have that suffix on their name. I mean it's not really a suffix, it's a component.
Yeah, I didn't know what to call it, just an ending, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could be called a suffix, but it is a component, I think, because it's like not secondary to the primary component, which would be Mara or Mari, or in the case of Jeroboam. I mean, even with Bible works, you don't really have instant. I guess I do if I scroll down and I go to the. Okay. If I go to the Brown Driver Briggs, when I look at the actual Hebrew term instead of the English, because the English only gets Strong's Concordance. If I look at the Hebrew term in Brown Driver Briggs, Jeroboam, it means which is the people, contend. The people contend. So it means rebellious people. The people contend. According to Brown Driver Briggs.
The people there basically being Ephraim, right?
Well, Ephraim as a description for the 10 northern tribes.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
I mean, that would be the theological interpretation of it.
I think that the word Europe comes from Jeroboam. I think I mentioned this before, but I mean, so the J is a Y, so we keep saying Jeroboam, but we're talking about Yeroboam. And then that B could be a P, because a lot of that is, a lot of the words that are B's are actually P's. They're interchangeable, it seems. Yoruba, M, or Yoruba. That's what I think.
Yeah. I can see the similarity between the primary component of Jeroboam and the word Europa. I could see that. The Greek term Europa was said to mean broad land, and other meanings have been given to the actual Greek term over time. I really never took the time to see if that makes sense looking at the components. Maybe I should do that soon.
There was a character too, right, in the ancient classics called Europa. It was the daughter, she was the sister of two of the brothers. You would know, you've read it, I've never read it. Correct? In the classic plays, the older ones.
Well, it might be mentioned in Homer too, but I'm not sure. Europa was the sister or the aunt or the niece of Heracles. I forget the details. I really do.
Are you guys getting background noise for me? No?
Just very little.
Okay.
I hear some female voice in the background.
Yeah, they're all having dinner outside. It's like paper thin, these windows. All mute.
Microphone muted.
It's not really disturbing.
Well, going
back to Ezekiel chapter 11 in verse 3, it which say, it is not near, let us build houses, this city is the cauldron, and we be the flesh. That's just an allegory that they want to remain in the city in their sin, and they are not believing that the end is near. Where Ezekiel was warning them that judgment is coming because they multiplied their slain and filled the streets with the slain. We saw the same thing in Jeremiah, I believe, where the nobility of the people were basically abusing and oppressing the commoners. So Ezekiel's telling them that they're going to see the sword. Verses 9 and 10.
I can continue if you all want me to.
Please.
Again, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, your brethren, even your brethren, the men of your kindred, and all the house of Israel, holy are they unto whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem have said, Get you far from Yahweh. Unto us is this land given in possession. Therefore say, Thus says Yahweh God, Although I have cast them far off among the heathen, and although I have scattered them among the countries, yet will I be to them as a little sanctuary in the countries where they shall come. Therefore say, Thus says Yahweh God, I will even gather you from the people and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they shall come thither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof and all the abominations thereof from thence. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. And I will take the stony heart out of your flesh and will give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. But as for them whose heart walks after the heart of their detestable things and their abominations, I will recompense their way upon their own heads, says Yahweh God. Then did the cherubims lift up their wings and the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel was over them above. And the glory of Yahweh went up from the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain which is on the east side of the city. Afterwards, the Spirit took me up and brought me in a vision by the Spirit of God into Chaldea, to them of the captivity. So the vision that I had seen went up from me. Then I spoke unto them of the captivity all the things that Yahweh had showed me.
So, Bill, in the first verse, it's the people who remained in Jerusalem thought that the land had been given to them because the others were taken away captive.
That's what it seems, and I don't remember exactly where it is. It earlier in Ezekiel, it seemed like the only people that Yahweh approved of out of Jerusalem were the 10,000 that Nebuchadnezzar has taken as hostages when he replaced, I think it was Jehoiachin, with Zedekiah. When Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin, all right, Jehoiakim died, he was already subject to the Babylonians. Jehoiachin, his son, only ruled about 9 months. If I have the names in the right order, I believe I do. Well, he was taken hostage with 10,000 of the princes of Judah, the chief men of Judah, and Ezekiel and Daniel were both among them. And they were all taken hostage to Babylon. And it seemed like they were the only people in Jerusalem that Yahweh favored, and all the rest were in disfavor. And where it says inhabitants of Jerusalem, in my opinion, that indicates to us that not all these people are Judah. And we'll see that in Ezekiel chapter 16. And we already saw it in Jeremiah, especially in Jeremiah chapter 2. That Jerusalem had become a cosmopolitan city, a mixed race city of people of various ethnicities. And many of them were evidently on the side of oppressing the children of Israel. And we see that reflected here in this chapter. Get ye far, this land was given to us for inheritance. And that basically expresses a people who are being disenfranchised by an infiltrating minority, which is the same thing we see today in all of our nations today. How does this not correlate to today? It certainly does.
I know there's one CI Light group that claims that because Christ said, there's this parable that Christ uses, and he says, "Has thou not, you know, taught in our streets and lived in our streets?" But then Jesus replies to them, "I have never known you." But because the people say to Jesus, "You have taught in our streets," they assume they must be Judahites. But here, what you're saying is, you know, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, just because you live in Jerusalem doesn't mean you're a Judahite.
"We have eaten and drunk in thy presence, and thou hast taught in our streets. But he shall say, I tell you, I know not whence ye are, depart from me." Just because they were inhabitants of that city doesn't mean that they were the people that he came to teach. Right.
Microphone activated.
That pretty much describes the Jews of today.
So if Christ goes to Detroit, he's not going to be talking to the niggers in Detroit.
I mean, that verse, from the way it's worded in Luke chapter 13, that's very much the attitude of the Jews of today, that Jesus was a Jew, so he's one of them. So you shouldn't believe him, you should believe Jews instead. That's their attitude, and that's what all the denominational churches have now accepted.
I think it's really evident in the parable, because Christ goes on and he's like, "And you will weep and lament when you see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom, but you're not allowed in." And they're always like, Abraham was a Jew, even though Judah wasn't born yet, but they still push that. Isaac was a Jew, Jacob was a Jew. Judah's not even around. They still call them Jews, right? They think it's their people, their ancestors, and they'll be allowed in the kingdom, but they'll be thrust out.
Yeah, but the answer to that is, why wasn't Ishmael a Jew?
Right, that too, yeah.
and then when they say, because it comes down through the mother, then you have to ask them, then how was Sarah a Jew?
I really hate it whenever you see churchianity people call Abraham a Jew. It's just intellectually dishonest.
It's also like Christ says, "I know not from whence you came." That's origin. So that means you're being rejected because of your origin. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you're right, Noble. It is annoying when they claim that everyone in the Bible is Jewish.
So they were all Jews. Why aren't we all Jews?
There's another verse they use, Bill. They'll say, you know, that verse in John where it says, "He came to his countrymen, but his countrymen accepted him not," or something like that. And it's like, oh, he came to his own. He came to his own. Oh, so they must all be, you know, the same as Jesus. But it you translated it, his countrymen.
Right.
So it's obvious that the men of the country aren't all of the same stock.
Well, yeah, right. It's how those words were actually used colloquially among the Greeks. The King James translations and the denominational translations don't reflect how those words were actually used in Greek. And when it says he came into his own, the word is ta idia, and it's a neuter plural noun. It has nothing to do with people because it's neuter.
So it's not his own people, it's his own land, it's just the land. So you could be an inhabitant of that land, but have no connection with Christ.
And that's hoi idioi. Now that refers to people. Tahi hoi idioi auton. And that doesn't necessarily refer back to Christ, that refers back to the land, and hoi idioi of just the inhabitants. And that's the way the phrase was colloquially used in Greek. I mean, I explained that in translating John 1:11-13. I hope I do.
Well, that's probably where I got it from, because that's just what I thought of when you said, you know, these are the inhabitants of Jerusalem rather than the, like, their true Judahites. I just thought of those things in the New Testament.
Yeah, right. I mean, there is a correlation there. I admit that there is a correlation there. It's odd in Ezekiel chapter 11, verse 13, that even though Benaiah was pretty wicked, Ezekiel still kind of lamented him there. Ah, Lord God, wilt thou make a full end of the remnant of Israel?
Isn't he lamenting more the remnant than Benaiah? Like, maybe he's afraid that Yahweh just won't stop, and he'll just keep on putting judgment on everyone until they're all gone.
It may be, but he's nevertheless lamenting them to a degree.
Right. It reminds me of Moses, when Yahweh promised Moses that he would start over with him, or at least tested him, by saying that, and Moses showed his love for his people, even though they were stiff-necked, he showed his love.
That's a good observation, because there is a correlation here. So, in verses 15 and 16, we have another confirmation, because it had been, by the time Ezekiel began prophesying, it had been at least 80 years since the deportations of Israel had been completed, and most of Judah, since all the Assyrian deportations had been completed, is at least 80 years by this time. And verses 15 and 16 are another affirmation that Yahweh was going to continue to be their God, even though they were cast far off among the heathen and scattered among the countries. Yet I will be to them as a little sanctuary in the countries where they shall come. So regardless of how far off they're scattered, Yahweh is their sanctuary. Then we have another promise of gathering. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I will take the stony heart out of their flesh and give to them a heart of flesh. And I think that should correlate to Jeremiah chapter 31 and the promise that the law would be written on our hearts. So he's given them a new heart that they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them.
Microphone activated. Microphone muted.
And that describes the Christian era, as far as I'm concerned. But it's still forthcoming at this time. The law written in our hearts being associated with the new covenant in Jeremiah chapter 31. I don't know if you finished the chapter or not when you read.
Oh, I did, yeah.
Okay, then I can talk about the cherubim. This is it. Ezekiel is watching the glory of the God of Israel depart from the temple. He's gone. He's departed from the temple. He's not coming back to the temple. That represents his disaffection from the temple in Jerusalem for all of their transgressions that we saw at the beginning of the chapter and in the previous chapter, with the men that were worship in the temple, worshiping the sun last week. And all their other abominations, all those pagan rites being carried out in the temple that we read in the previous chapters. There'll be more descriptions of it. It gets worse.
So, Bill, the Spirit of God departs at the time of Ezekiel from the temple. But then when Jesus is baptized, the Spirit lands on him.
Well, you know, that could that's a good analogy, Joe, because that works. That could be a sign that Christ is the new temple. Because Christ is the temple of God. I mean, I believe he was born God, right? He was born Yahweh in the flesh, Yahweh incarnate. But that would be a sign to the people that he is now the temple, yes.
There's an interesting part in Malachi where it says he will come swiftly to his temple in regards to the Messiah.
Yes, that is true. That's a good analogy. That's a good observation too. Or it says he will come swiftly to his temple. I mean, yeah, you could say that that is the Spirit descending on Christ. And I don't think that's when God came into the body of Christ as his temple. I think that's only a sign to the people that Christ was God, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree.
But Christ also went swiftly to the temple after he was born, right?
Oh, yeah, literally. Yeah, true.
So yes, all of those prophetic metaphors and allegories, they all fit together.
It's really profound.
Yeah, well, the scripture's deep, and to even discuss everything that's found in the scripture, I might get 1,600 more podcasts and still not be done.
Yep.
And then other people would be able to extrapolate on that. That's the way it is. The scripture's deep, man.
Yeah, it's a holy book.
Yeah. It's not like a book of like the poetic edits that all conflict with one another and tell different stories and don't really say anything.
I shouldn't have said a holy book. I should have said the holy book.
Yeah.
And it's all like separate men, and they're having separate visions, and somehow they all come together.
Yeah. But the poetic edits, when you get from one end to another, all you end up with is a bunch of drunks and faggots. I'm sorry.
And trannies. There's a tranny in there as well.
Yeah, there's a few trannies in there.
Imagine saying, that's what I believe in. I'm a hardcore white nationalist pagan. And I believe in the Eddas and the trannies and the faggots.
Yep.
Who's the tranny? Was it Thor or Loki? I can't remember.
Odin and Thor were both trannies.
Oh, Odin and Thor. Right.
Apparently, I've heard stories that the priests used to dress as women and trick young men. It's all disgusting.
Odin dressed up like a woman in the Eddas so that he could trick Freya into telling him the secrets that only women could know. So not only was he a tranny, he was a feminist. Because he had to get secrets from a woman. And Thor dressed up like a woman so that he could get his hammer back from the giant Mjolnir that stole his hammer. So Thor had to risk getting hammered to get his hammer back. Go figure that one out.
And doesn't Loki like shapeshift into an animal and have sex with an animal?
Yeah, Loki does that a few times. And actually, Loki was the father of Odin's horse. It had six legs or eight legs or something like that. Because Loki was its father. Yeah. So you have animal sex, you got trannies, you got fags. It's all in the Eddas.
So if someone came along and said, I'm a pagan and I stand against race mix, and it's like, mate, you got this guy who's like breeding with animals, okay?
Yeah, right.
Get lost.
Exactly.
It's fucking satanic. It's satanic.
Being pagans, they have no morality to stand on, that they have no foundation for their morality. And they really don't realize how much they're Christians. Because Christianity has been imbued in the culture for 2,000 years. We don't know. Most people can't conceive of what life would be like if we never had Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah, Christianity is character and action, not pomp and ritual, but most people don't understand.
Right. That I always like to point out the Heimskringla, where King An of Sweden sacrificed 9 of his sons, each of them, so that he could live an extra and rule for an extra 10 years. And he kept sacrificing his sons until the people finally revolted and wouldn't let him sacrifice his last son so that he could live another 10 years, and he died.
What a great guy.
Yeah. So we have child sacrifice and human, most of them weren't children, most of them were adults. We have child sacrifice and human sacrifice in the Eddas, but we have trannies, we have faggots, we have everything perverted. Where the Bible is a book that stands against all that consistently from one end to the other, that all that is evil.
It's the only book.
If a woman puts on the things of a man, it's an abomination to God, and vice versa.
I don't think there's any other text in the world which makes a stand.
No, religious Quran one. Is just like the Talmud in many ways, where it justifies certain sins of the body that the Bible frowns upon.
That's kind of like the law written in our hearts. Because when I see a man dressed as a woman, I hate it, you know?
Right.
But these Jews don't have that. Sorry?
It's disgusting. It's totally revolting when you see a man in a dress pretending to be a woman. You just want to kill him.
And the reason, if they're white, the reason they get so aggressive with you when you rebuke them and they start screaming and doing all that shit is because their conscience, it's like the law's written on their heart and they're always having to like internally fight themselves. That's what I believe anyways.
Yeah, a lot of people are like numb, I think noble, or and that's why they sort of arc up, they sort of get enraged straight away because it's like you're hitting a nerve, a tendon that, you know, that they've tried to numb.
They know it's wrong deep inside.
Gentlemen, I need just a minute. I'll be right back. You can start reading 12 whenever you want, though.
I'll start if it's good with you guys.
Yeah, I reckon you should, yeah.
The word of Yahweh also came unto me, saying, Son of man, you dwell in the midst of a rebellious house, which have eyes to see and see not. They have ears to hear and hear not, for they are a rebellious house. Therefore, you son of man, prepare you stuff for removing, and remove by day in their sight. And you shall remove from your place to another place in their sight. It may be they will consider, though they be a rebellious house. Then shall you bring forth your stuff by day in their sight, as stuff for removing. And you shall go forth at evening in their sight, as they that go forth into captivity. Dig you through the wall in their sight, and carry out thereby. In their sight shall you bear it upon your shoulders, and carry it forth in the twilight. And you shall cover your face, and you shall not see the ground, for I have set you for a sign unto the house of Israel. And I did so as I was commanded. I brought forth my stuff by day as stuff for captivity. And in the evening I digged through the wall with my hand. I brought it forth in the twilight, and I bare it upon my shoulder in their sight.
And in the morning came the word of Yahweh unto me, saying, Son of man, has not the house of Israel, the rebellious house, said unto you, What are you doing? Say you unto them, Thus says Yahweh God, This burden concerns the prince in Jerusalem, and all the house of Israel that are among them. Say, I am your sign. Like as I have done, so shall it be done unto them. They shall remove and go into captivity. And the prince that is among them shall bear upon his shoulder in the twilight, and shall go forth. They shall dig through the wall to carry out thereby. He shall cover his face, that he see not the ground with his eyes. My net also will I spread upon him, and he shall be taken in my snare. And I will bring him to Babylon, to the land of the Chaldeans. Yet shall he not see it, though he shall die there. And I will scatter toward every wind all that are about him to help him, and all his bands. And I will draw out the sword after them. And they shall know that I am Yahweh, when I shall scatter them among the nations and disperse them in the countries. But I will leave a few men of them from the sword and from the famine and from the pestilence, that they may declare all their abominations among the heathen where they come. And they shall know that I am Yahweh.
Yeah, you know, we're never told that Ezekiel actually went to Jerusalem. We're never told that. Maybe I'm missing something. I never saw that we were told that, but he was only told to lay on his side and to make this model of Jerusalem or this depiction of Jerusalem on a brick and to address that. And yet he sees all these things that are actually going on in the city. I don't think that we're told that he's still by the river Kabar, as far as I'm concerned, yet he seems to be in the city the way the prophecy is being recorded. It's Yahweh himself in the city and telling Ezekiel all these things, is my opinion, that Ezekiel's actually not there in reality.
Sort of like how John wasn't really there when he was having his visions, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, John was seeing visions. He wasn't actually there, but he wrote like it was all absolutely real to him and that he was there. And I believe that in his perception, it certainly was real to him. And I think the same thing's going on here in Ezekiel. And it seems like he's there. But as far as we know about his location, he's really by the river Kabar in Babylonia, in captivity. This is only a year after he began his prophecies, when he was told that he was going to lay on his side for 390 days on one side, and I forget exactly how many days it was on the other side, but it was a considerable period, at least a couple of months, 75 days or something like that. So that's a year and a half period right there, practically. Maybe a little less, but not much less. And this is the sixth year, I believe. And it's still the sixth year. Ezekiel chapter 8, and it came to pass in the sixth year, in the sixth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I sat in mine house, and the elders of Judah sat before me. Now that house is in Babylonia, it's not in Jerusalem, in Ezekiel chapter 8, and the context hasn't broken since Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel was never actually went to Jerusalem physically.
Is this prophecy like Ezekiel's in the shoes of the princes that are trying to escape Jerusalem, but then Yahweh spread a net for them and caught them as they're trying to escape, and then they're taken away to Babylon. Is that what it's saying? Or because I'm trying to understand what it's saying here. Because it sounds like, okay, it refers to the princes. And then the prince that is among them shall bear upon his shoulder in the twilight, and shall go forth. They shall dig through the city. So he's escaping the city, this prince. But my net I will spread upon him, and I will bring him to Babylon, and I will scatter toward every wind and send the sword after them. So I don't. Is that what this prophecy is about, or is it about like a remnant coming out of Jerusalem that isn't the, you know?
It sounds like Zedekiah to me, because it says he won't see it.
And he will die in Babylon. He shall die there, yeah. And I will bring him to Babylon, to the land of the Chaldeans, yet shall he not see it, though he shall die there. He shall not see it, so he's blinded. Wasn't Zedekiah blinded?
Yeah, was that's it Zedekiah? Why I'm thinking. Yeah, it was Zedekiah, so that's why I'm thinking it's Zedekiah. And he tried to escape Jerusalem, if I remember correctly, with his sons, right? And they killed all his sons.
Yes. So it's like Ezekiel, like envisioning himself as
the
prince.
Did that guy die in Babylon, though?
I don't know. I don't know that much. I'd have to look that up. Sorry.
Yeah, he went to Babylon, Jeremiah chapter 52. He was caught. They caught him up to him in the desert, right? We discussed that just about five weeks ago, maybe. But they caught him in the desert when he was trying to escape, and they carried him to Riblah in the land of Hamath, where he gave judgment upon him. And the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. He slew also all the princes of Judah in Riblah. Everybody that was with Zedekiah. Then he put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and the king of Babylon bound him in chains and carried him to Babylon and put him in prison till the day of his death. So he died in Babylon, which agrees with what we see in this chapter.
So could have Ezekiel been prophecy? Is that what this prophecy is about, Bill?
It very much seems to be. This concerneth the prince in Jerusalem. Yeah, you know, not the princes like the chief men, but the prince, which would basically be the ruler, right?
Oh, I just saw it. Verse 10, it says, "Say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord God, this burden concerneth the prince in Jerusalem." Yeah.
So it seems to be Zedekiah.
So could the first few verses refer to someone else where they're digging through the wall and he's escaping Jerusalem? Could that be someone else? Or is this whole thing like referring to the prince trying to escape and he gets caught?
Yeah, this is why Ezekiel can't really be in Jerusalem, right? Ezekiel's not digging through walls with his hands. But he's described as digging through walls, which tells me that Ezekiel is seeing things that men really can't see, right? Yeah, you know what I mean? It's a way to illustrate that. Ezekiel seeing things that men really can't see. The prophet's not digging through a wall by himself, believe me. But those city walls were thick, 20 feet thick and hard. And it's just not happening. That this digging through walls is an allegory by which the prophet can see things or represent things that are going to happen that haven't really happened, right? That's how I see that. So then shalt thou bring forth thy stuff by day in their sight as stuff for removing. That stuff could be vessels, implements, whatever. And thou shalt go even in her sight as they that go forth into captivity. Dig through the wall in her sight and carry out thereby. In their sight thou shalt bear it upon thy shoulders and carry it forth in the twilight. That is really esoteric and kind of strange, and I think I need to study that a little more. Thou dwellest in the midst of a rebellious house. Well, is that Ezekiel couldn't have actually been there? So I have to contemplate this and what it could really mean.
I remember in Amos, Yahweh describes the coming captivity as a time of darkness. And maybe that's why it's twilight here in Ezekiel. It's a time of darkness.
Well, yes, I would agree with that. But Amos really only dealt with the captivities of Israel.
Right, yeah. This is Babylon.
Yahweh's telling Ezekiel to dig through the wall and carry out stuff, which is implements or vessels or materials or whatever.
Did Zedekiah and his men try to take any treasure from the temple when they fled?
That might be. Let me go back to Jeremiah 52. The city was besieged. There was a sore famine. The city was broken up. That means the wall was breached. And all the men of war fled and went forth out of the city by night, which was by the way of the king's garden. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued after the king and overtook Zedekiah. There's no mention of them having any stuff with them, right? And any treasure. I imagine that once the wall was breached and they realized that they were going to be defeated, that the soldiers and the armies tried to flee and Zedekiah tried to flee, they didn't have a lot of time to pack. They had no time to pack. The way that description is, it fled as soon as the walls were breached. They had no time to pack.
Especially not treasure, which likely weighs a lot.
Right.
Okay, I was just thinking maybe.
The book of Nezar, when he installed Zedekiah as king, had actually taken most of the treasure already. Everybody took it all.
All right. Yeah, I remember that. Okay.
So this taking of stuff and what it symbolizes is kind of difficult for me to discern.
Yeah, I'm out of ideas.
Say, I am your sign. Like as I have done, so shall it be done unto them. They shall remove and go into captivity. So perhaps Ezekiel's taking of stuff actually represents what the Babylonians are going to do to the people of Jerusalem. I am your sign. Say, I am your sign. Like as I have done, breaking the wall and taking your stuff, so shall it be done unto them. They shall remove and go into captivity. So that's what the taking of stuff signifies. Ezekiel dug through the wall and took all their stuff, right? Took all the stuff in their sight. Is symbolic of the fact that the Babylonians are going to come, break their walls, and take all their stuff. That's what it means. Verse 11. They shall dig through the wall to carry out thereby. Jeremiah 52, that's what the Babylonians did. They breached the walls, and then the king tried to flee. And he couldn't.
Makes sense to me.
So that's, this does cross-reference to...
Microphone activated.
This is what's going to happen. And it cross-reference, it does cross-reference to what happened in Jeremiah chapter 52. I will bring him to Babylon, to the land of the Chaldeans, yet he shall not see it, because as Joe said, his eyes were put out before he got there, though he shall die there. And this is about Zedekiah, and that is what happened to Zedekiah. He went to Babylon, but he never saw it because his eyes were already put out at Riblah. And he died at Babylon. So there you have it. That's what it means. Verse 13 verses.
I think you're up to 17, Noble.
Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, eat your bread with quaking, and drink your water with trembling, and say unto the people of the land, Thus saith Yahweh God of the inhabitants of Jerusalem and of the land of Israel, They shall eat their bread with carefulness, and drink their water with astonishment, that her land may be desolate from all that is therein, because of the violence of all them that dwell therein. And the cities that are inhabited shall be laid waste, and the land shall be desolate, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, what is that proverb that you have in the land of Israel, saying, The days are prolonged, and every vision fails? Tell them, therefore, thus says Yahweh God, I will make this proverb to cease, and they shall no more use it as a proverb in Israel. But say unto them, The days are at hand, and the effect of every vision. For there shall be no more any vain vision nor flattering divination within the house of Israel. For I am Yahweh, I will speak, and the word that I shall speak shall come to pass. It shall be no more prolonged. For in your days, O rebellious house, will I say the word and will perform it, says Yahweh God. Again, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, behold, they of the house of Israel say, The vision that he sees is for many days to come, and he prophesies of a time far off. Therefore say unto them, Thus says Yahweh God, There shall none of my words be prolonged any more. But the word which I have spoken shall be done, says Yahweh God.
Reminds me of futurism.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, Noble.
Remind you of the will that denominational Christians have, who desire futurism because they don't believe they're being punished today.
Yeah, they somehow believe they're in the good times, somehow.
Yeah, they do. It's incredible. They're being taxed out of 50% of their earnings. They're being overrun by aliens. Their daughters are fucking niggers, and they believe they're in good times. And they don't realize that they're in captivity and they're being oppressed. Because really, in our lifetimes, we never experienced good times. I don't think we have.
No. I mean, I think we have glimpses of it. Like Ecclesiastes talks about the comfort of food and the work of your hands. And I think that's a glimpse.
Yeah, in medieval times, they had like 150 days a year off. Holy days.
Yeah, I was just talking about that on the forum or the chat the other day.
I saw that.
But even though it's that they were filled with idolatry, right? I mean, the people had like a third of the year off. At least 120 and possibly more, depending on where they were. of the holy Catholic or Orthodox liturgical days, they had a third of the year off just for religious feasts. So they had to go to church and stuff like that, but they had off, they didn't work for a third of the year. Aside from the regular Sabbaths, the regular Sundays.
You know, if you try to convince modern people that they live in slavery, it's extremely difficult. They think that you're somewhat nuts, even if you like go into like a pedantic explanation where they can actually understand what you're saying. They can't really come to the same conclusion because they just think that everything's great now. They don't have the concept of working for themselves. They don't have the concept of not spending 10 hours a day, 5 days a week working, because with commuting, it's pretty much 50 hours a week that most people work. They work for a corporation or government. And they don't get the idea. They don't just cannot understand the concept that they're in slavery, right? Very frustrating. They can get there halfway, but they can't get there full way.
Yeah. If you're going to spend a day waiting in a motor vehicle office for a license so you drive, or for license plates or registration, and I've done that in my life. In New Jersey, it was horrible. You'd spend 6 hours in the motor vehicle office just to renew your registration or renew your driver's license. That's slavery. Yeah, and then you take 2 days to do your taxes. You take 2 days to calculate your taxes and how much you owe the government. And that's a tax on top of your tax. That 2 days, or however long it might take.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they think the government's benevolent and only exists to help them, and they like worship the government, and they don't see that they're slaves. It's so crazy. It's a crazy world. It's clown world, like we say.
You know, when they hear the term, when people hear the term slavery, all they think of is whips. It's like, if I'm not being whipped, so I'm not a slave. Like, what the fuck are you talking about, buddy? Right? That's how they look at it. Like, nobody's whipping me. But they are being whipped, but it's a different sort of whip, right? It's a figurative whip. It's not, you know, across their back giving them big lashes, right?
It might end up being that way, though.
Yeah.
It's like the way the economy is structured. It's structured in a way to make sure you're a slave, because you have to work 50 hours a week and your wife has to work 50 hours a week just so that you can buy a loaf of bread and a few small things. No, and they don't get that. They think, oh, well, they're not literally making me do it and beating me, so I'm not a slave, I guess.
Yeah, you're right, Joe. They think of it as it's their choice. But the truth of the matter is, if they want a home and a car and all that other stuff, there is no other choice. I mean, there is for a small portion of the population, but for most people, there is no choice. You have to conform or you don't get that stuff.
They think the world is just the way it is by like some sort of coincidence. Like, oh, that's just the way the economy is. It's just sort of just happened. You know, it just happens. It's not, they can't imagine that it could be structured that way, you know, intentionally to exploit them or manipulate them.
Yeah.
So that a bunch of parasites who are good for nothing can like, exploit them and manipulate them.
Well, verse 27 here is, that was a good observation. It's a good example of the attitudes of people today that would rather believe in futurism than the actual fact that prophecy has been fulfilled and is being fulfilled. They would rather just believe that this is far off in the future. I'd rather be left behind.
And then even that isn't enough for them. They want to believe that when it does start, they'll be raptured.
Like, yeah. Yeah, they won't, because they believe in Jesus, so they're going to be raptured. But that's not what Paul is describing at all. And then they have a total disconnect when they repeat the Our Father prayer, and thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Well, then what do you want to be raptured for?
You know what? Some Jehovah's Witnesses knocked on my door, I'd say like 3 or 4 months ago. And there were two young guys, like I'd say like late 20s. And, you know, they could see like right away that I knew about the Bible, and they were still had to do their, like, we'd like to come over and, you know, teach you this stuff. And I was like, no, that's not going to happen. But what you just said reminded me, because at some point in the conversation, I said, yeah, but, you know, kingdom come will be right here on earth. And the one guy, he was like, yes, that's right. He understood that. And I said, yeah, it's because it's in the Lord's Prayer, right? Just like you just said. And I was surprised, because I didn't know that there are any Judeo-Christians out there that understood that. But he understood. And all I said as a joke, I said, well, kind of a joke, I said, yeah, kingdom will be here, but it'll be presumably a lot cleaner. And he laughed, because he nodded his head. He was like, yes, that's right. So I didn't know that any Judeos actually believed in that, but apparently they know that the kingdom's going to be here on earth in the resurrection. I mean, unless he was just a rogue, right?
No, Jehovah Witnesses, they do believe in an earthly kingdom, but they believe it will have a population of 104,000.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, boy. We never got that far in the conversation. Yeah.
So they think there will be an earthly kingdom, but there won't be many people there.
Why 104? Were they 144, you mean?
Well, from Revelation.
144,000 from Revelation.
Oh, okay. Oh, so they believe that. Okay. I thought you said 104.
That's their whole thing. It's like the main thing of their whole theology.
Okay.
Yeah,
if you look up Jehovah's Witnesses, there were like, I don't know, 5 million of them or more. No, it's 8.7 million.
Got to be the best one. It's a competition against your brother.
Yeah, right. Well, okay, divide or subtract 144,000 from 8.7 million, and you're going to end up with a hell of a lot of disappointed people.
Yep.
I remember Clifton mocking that long ago in much the same way, but when he wrote it, it was only like 5 million, right? So
growing.
He was saying the same thing.
The CI Light schools that believe that, Bill, they believe 144,000 and that they're one of the 144,000 and the rest of the white race goes to hell.
Yeah.
You know, just
the
Jehovah.
I think 144,000 is at least a nigger or two in it.
Paul's always writing in his epistles to the assemblies on how not to have strife and jealousy and contention within the assemblies. And I can't think of a better way to have jealousy and strife than to look at all your brethren as competitors for like 144,000 lottery race. Like, come on.
Yeah, it makes no sense at all. And it leads to the same self-righteousness that Judeo-tardism, any form of salvation by works is it leads to self-righteousness.
Yeah.
To scorn for all your brethren who sinned and to look down upon them. To be envious of your brethren who appear to be better off than you or more holy than you or whatever. It's one man against his brother, right? In a way that Christ never intended.
If your brother's sinning, that's a good thing, because he's lost his place and maybe you move up the chart a little bit.
Yeah, right. You move up one.
Yeah, that's like Freemasonry. Yeah. You get a higher degree.
Say you die and go to hell and you're like rats. Not enough of them sinned. I couldn't get up there. I never had a chance. Okay. The whole thing is ridiculous.
Maybe that's what maybe the Jews really are the real people of the Bible, and the reason they're peddling so much sin is they're trying to get to the top. You know, they're trying to push porn, they're trying to push drugs, fornication, and then when all the other people sin, they'll win. Well, it's a Jewish idea, Bill.
How do they miss the innumerable multitude that's described right after the 144,000? How do they miss the innumerable multitude in Revelation chapter 7 that have washed their garments in the blood of the Lamb? How do they miss that?
I found that they'll cut verses in half and extract like a few words from a part of a verse and put it together with a few words from another and then combine it into one teaching.
Yeah, well, so sick.
I lost where we were up to. Did we finish at chapter Noble?
Yeah, we did. We finished.
Oh, okay.
We left on there for tonight, I think. It'll be an abbreviated night, but that's all right. We get a late start.